You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Homes.com knows having the right agent can make or break your home search. That's why they provide home shoppers with an agent directory that gives you a detailed look at each agent's experience, like the number of closed sales in a specific neighborhood, average price range, and more. It lets you easily connect with all the agents in the area you're searching, so you can find the right agent with the right experience and ultimately the right home for you. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
The Podcast Playground.
Hooray!
Hi, I'm Buzz Knight, and this is the Take It a Walk podcast, where we take you on an audio journey with a variety of really cool folks, all with a story to tell, a story about music, a story about the artist, the backstory. On this episode, I go back to the glorious radio days in Boston, which I was part of and certainly observed. We have a talent who dominated the air in Boston, also in New York, and across the country in his time on Sirius XM. We go over to Central Park to take a walk next with Nick Carter.
Well, Nick Carter, it is so great to be actually taking a walk in person with you in Central Park, New York City.
Hey, it's great to be with you, man. And as I say, I'm hoping I'm the first one to take the show title literally, because I brought my youthful ward, Peppermint, P. Dot Mint, the Mint. My dog, as she's known on the mean streets of the Upper West Side. She's already blessed the place with the poop, so, you know, so far, so good.
I love it. I love it. You are the first person that has brought the pooch along to take a walk. Although, I did an episode of Taking a Walk with my two knucklehead dogs in Carlisle, Massachusetts.
So. Wow. That's beautiful. Yeah, I'm a big believer in the sight gag. It's called Taking a Walk, so...
I love it.
And I'm sitting on the subway, I'm going, he's going to think I'm the biggest doofus there is.
No way. No way. I'm the guy that did it with my two dogs. I'm the doofus.
Well, she's got...
six people who listen to it.
She's got kind of a... it's funny because she's got kind of a tragic story. I mean, my Instagram is basically pictures of me and past their prime, past their sell-by celebrities, and Peppermint. And Peppermint, you know, just... whatever, you know, running around doing her thing to videos. Like, my favorite vet says of small dogs, she's like, you got to be careful with these low riders. So she's running around chasing another small dog to a war low rider. And, you know, literally that video got more pictures, more likes than a picture of me and Robert Plant. And everybody's like, Peppermint should have her own Instagram. I'm like, no, so she has more followers than me? Hard pass. But... she had a really, it's interesting. Oh, what are you doing? She had a really tough life. She was abandoned on the streets of the Bronx at 2 months old, which blows my mind. I mean, how much would it have taken just to drop her off at a vet or a shelter? And her mom, well, my dog, who's a Havanese, passed away 2 months, actually this month, 2 years ago, 2 months before she turned 16. And her human mom, passed away 2 months after that.
Oh, man.
And so I kind of inherited her. I mean, she was living with me. She'd been living with me for a couple of years. And Bianca, her mom, passed away at only 43. And all her friends are like, well, you're keeping Peppermint, right? I'm like, no, I thought I'd put her on eBay.
I mean, really.
Yeah, so, but that's the story of Peppermint, or the Mint, as she's known on the mean streets of the Upper West Side.
Well, I'm so honored to meet the Mint, and I'm glad to see you. I haven't seen you in a while. I think the last time I saw you was at a big event that was involved when you were doing the national show on tap.
Right. Yeah.
On
tap with Nick Carter.
Yeah.
Which, you know, some of the best 3 years of my life. You know, I got yelled at by Peter Frampton. I got called names by George Thorogood. It was great. I used to have longer hair then. I used to joke, VH1 Classic has hired a spiky-haired black guy to play classic rock to a bunch of red stage. What could possibly go wrong? I remember, like, my commercial. Thank God VH1 Classic had next to no ads. So it was either my promo, me, or the slap chop guy. And Slash came in. I mean, I talked to him a couple of times. And he's... Well, I'm one of those people that people know my name and know my face, but don't put them together, I think. And so... he had come in to do an interview, and he walks in the studio and he goes, oh, it's you. I see you every time I'm on the treadmill. How rock and roll. And I'm just trying to imagine Slash on the treadmill with a dopey top hat on. But yeah, that was a great experience, because I had sort of fancied myself, you know, like Johnny alt rock guy. And you know, I always kind of, I had a tacit respect for classic rock because that's the sort of building blocks of everything that I listened to. But my perception at that time, this is 2011, 2012, my perception was that, even though I was out of the demographic, as they like to say, I was like, oh, that's the old guy. That's the old guy format. So it was funny because when artists would come in, me, A, being a person of color, and B, being, you know, we're looking with this dopey baby face. I used to say to my boss, it's hilarious. They come in, and they're polite, but I think at first they're a little thrown off. Like, they're figuring, this guy has no idea who I am. You know, he's this guy. What did this guy take a break from his rap show to talk to me? You know,
yeah.
And they were shocked to find that not only did I know their music inside and out, I knew their stories, and they just... It was really weird. And my boss actually said to me, he's like, you know, we could kind of use that. And I'm like, you know, I get where you're coming from. I'm not sure that's legal for you to say, but all right, cool.
So where did you first realize that radio was in your blood?
Well, I grew up in Massachusetts. I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was a ham myself. I'm sorry. Please don't trip anybody. I started my career, quote unquote, I don't even know how old I was. I did, I guess seventh grade, I did a show for NPR called The Spider's Web, where I was like a youth reporter. But I was always a music nerd. I can remember the first 45 I bought, the first album I bought, and I just was fascinated by DJs. And I grew up listening to everybody from the great Sonny Joe White to JoJo Cook and Kincaid, these top 40 monsters, to Mark Parento on WBCN, who I just thought was a god. And then as I got older and I got in the business, I kind of got tagged with the Howard Stern shock jock thing, which bothered me because my goal, and that's what I feel like that I'll always be indebted to SiriusXM, my goal was to be like guys like Tom Snyder, Larry King, Tavis Smiley, who could literally talk to anyone. Like, I mean, I remember as a little boy watching The Clash, right? The Clash on the Tom Snyder Show at like 1 o'clock in the morning. And the next day he's talking to like Moshe Dayan, you know?
Right.
And I was like, how does that happen?
Yeah.
You know, and, but I just the idea of, I was a frustrated musician too, as are many radio personalities, and the idea that, you know, you could hear your voice over the music and it was sort of musical. It just I don't know, it was just something about it that just really, really turned me on. And then, you know, the idea that you could connect and, I was going to say be funny, or at least attempt to be funny on the air. It was just a great thing for me. And I also, you know, as I say, I started in public radio. And then when I was in seventh grade, I got my first TV show on Channel 4, WBZ in Boston. And it was, everybody's like, oh, I got to see tapes. No. They're in the vault with the Zapruder film and the porno from Hitler's bunker. Because I was an overweight kid. I had a huge space in my teeth. I had big, thick Coke bottle glasses, a huge afro. You know, it was like that. I mean, it was like the Death Star. It rivaled everybody from Jeff Lynne and Don Henley to Angela Davis. And I look back now and I'm like, how did my parents let me go on TV like that?
So what was the name of that show?
It was called Changing Places, where they took a bunch of kids and dropped them into the news anchor's positions. And I changed places with Jimmy Myers and did a sports cast, although I knew very little about sports. And then they liked me, and I got another show. It was called The City Show. Then they changed the name to Get Off Your Block, where I literally walked around in the summer and showed kids, you know, hey, go to the Science Museum. It's open and it's not that expensive. And I actually got an Emmy. I didn't get it, but my producer did. My first voiceover, this woman named Susan Bell, borrowed me. And she wanted me to voice a couple of promos, like public service announcements. And the first one was, they're wheeling this picture of this really sickly looking little white kid. I think he had red hair. And they're wheeling him down the hall on this gurney. And this kid, I mean, it's so, like, so 80s. He's like, you know, I was really, really sick. And then this really cool lady came up to me and helped me. And I thought she was a nurse. Turns out she was the doctor. Turns out you don't have to be a man to be a good doctor. You just have to be a good doctor. You know, and the key was like, it's being good at what you do that counts. It gets like gender, you know, whatever. And it won an Emmy. I didn't get it. I mean, it's at her house. And the funny thing is, the first woman who put me on TV, this woman, Gail Levine, she came to New York and she became a giant casting director. She cast the Cruise movie, Jerry Maguire.
Oh, wow.
And I looked her up and I called her and I was like, hi, it's Nick Carter. She's like, from childhood? I was like, yeah. I gotta call you back. Click. And that was the last I ever heard from her.
I gotta call you back.
Exactly. I was like, it's so Hollywood. Come on, you.
So this is all before your first radio gig.
Yes, sir.
Essentially.
Yeah. My first actual gig, quote unquote, being a DJ was in school, NYU, WNYU. I studied theater there. I literally almost got thrown out of the theater department because I would blow off class so much to go hang out at the radio station. And I did a couple of shows. Again, it was the 80s, so I did a club show called Club 89, where we broke records, like underground records that were being played that are now like club classics. I did a show. I inherited the disco show, Disco 89, which was literally a classic disco show from my friend Don Milano, who's now a big sales guy.
I know him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, he was like, he created it. And the funny thing is, you know, WNYU, since, you know, I lived on campus in the Village, the transmitters in the Bronx. So people on campus couldn't get the station, you know, so basically you were broadcasting to people who were just listening, you know, in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, you know, Westchester County, and a lot in Brooklyn. And this disco show was unbelievably popular. The phones would start ringing at like 8:30 on Wednesday. The show was on from 9 to 11, and they wouldn't stop ringing until like midnight. So I played disco. Wow. And I channeled my inner Sonny Joe White and screamed over, you know, Dan Hartman, Instant Replay or whatever. And I eventually get fired from my college radio station. And I moved back to Boston because I was broke. And New York was so expensive then. I mean, not like now, but. And I started working part-time at WFNX in Boston. I'd been turned down by, I think, two different program directors and the consultant. And then Max Tolkoff, who was the first guy to put me on the air, he brought me in. I remember he said, you know, the rest of these DJs need some of what you have, and you need to have some of what they have, because they were, I had to throw this poop away, they were all really, really mellow and laid back, and I was all hyper, and I was so excited to hear my voice over Depeche Mode in the middle of the night, and it was just, oh, my calls were hilarious. I remember my first night, I was like, you know, 101.7 FNX, Boston's alternative rock, blah, 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 blah. I picked up the phone, hi, FNX. What do you want, Kiss?
Or, oh, boy.
Which was the big top 40.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I remember this one woman was just like, dude, what are you doing? So I kind of mellowed out. And then WBCN had offered me part-time a couple of times, where I literally would have made more money 2 days a week on WBCN than I was making six nights a week on WFNX in the middle of the night. And I said no. And the legendary Oedipus, who was the program director, walked around for years because it kept on getting back to me.
No. Nick Carter said no to me. Yeah, my part-timers make more than their full-timers. No. What the hell's wrong with that guy?
Like, he sought out anybody he knew who knew me.
It's a good imitation.
No.
He's like a second father to me. So then I left, finally, and I went to do mornings in Providence, Rhode Island, and I was there for 6 months, and he called me.
Nick, I think you're ready.
I was like, oh, this ought to be fascinating. Okay.
You're ready to be on WBCN in Boston.
And I was like, all right. But, you know, I told these guys I'd be here a year. He's like, Nick, think about your future. Click. And dial them. And thank God my program director, Brent Peterson, said to me, he was like, listen, you can go in there and you can change that station. You know, because I didn't have a contract. I just gave him my word I'd be there 6 months. And he said to me, I do the me test on this. He's from Chicago. And he said, if Q101 or whatever the big station at the time called me, he said, I'd be so out of here. It's like, you got to go. And I said, well, I appreciate that. But, you know, I gave him my word I'm going to stay. And he said, okay, well, you can stay. But if you stay, I'm going to fire you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was so selfless. So I went back to Boston in 1996. And therapy and antidepressants were soon to follow.
Yeah, that was quite a run, right?
It was 8 years. It felt like twice that. Because it was insane. I look back now and we were in the middle of this unbelievably nasty rock battle. And it's hilarious to me because, I mean, not to be political, but I see a correlation between a lot of the MAGA stuff because it was almost cult-like. You know, this one radio station we competed with, WAAF, I mean, they tapped into something, a vein where literally these kids who... They thought it was a crusade to kind of go out and represent for this radio station that played a good 80% of the same stuff we did, you know? I mean, and that other 20% was the secret sauce. They were very heavy, and we were, you know, by comparison, kind of dorky, you know, in corporate. But they, you know, it was insane. I mean, I remember my dad was in the hospital. He had cancer. When I was hired to do night 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. at WBCN for 3 years, and I figured that was it. I was so naive. I didn't know that I was being groomed for afternoon drive then. Everybody else knew it but me. And I was just like, well, you know, I could afford to move out of mom's house now. I could also get a car. You know, because when I was at FNX, literally, I had friends that were working at fast food who were making more than I was. I was making $6 an hour. You know, I paid my dues. But, my dad had colon cancer. He had surgery. And when I moved to afternoons, I remember he was in the hospital and he was trying to recover. And stuff between this other radio station and I had spilled into the newspapers. And you know, they were finding coded language to make reference to me being black, so it was just, it got very, very nasty. I mean, I'm not a sponge. I mean, I'm pretty tough, but, you know, my parents were, like, freaked out, and I'll never forget going to the hospital to see my dad, and my dad was like, because, you know, I was going out doing appearances, and my dad was like, do they have enough security for you? And I'm like, Dad, these knuckleheads are just going to get in my face and say something. Nobody's going to, like, put hands on me. But, you know, that really bothered me because, you know, if you have any dealings with cancer, stress is everything.
Right.
You know, and so it really got to him. And I was like, Dad, you know, I was 50 pounds heavier then. I was like, I'm a big guy, you know, I mean, nobody knew that I was a complete, you know, marshmallow inside. I'm loud and I can talk a good game. What? What? Step outside and we'll talk about it.
Right.
And the second they go outside and I'm inside like,
yeah.
But, you know, it was,
See, I had, you know, I was there and I knew the battle, but I, now that you're telling the story from your view, though, I had forgotten how kind of evil and nasty the whole thing had gotten.
I got called the N-word so much, and I couldn't even get angry at these kids because I knew they didn't even really know what they were saying. They would just call up the station, you know, say it and, like, hang up. And really, you know, it was Opie and Anthony, who I think are incredibly talented, but they were their own worst enemy. You know, I've never seen anybody with a bigger self-destruct mechanism than those guys. You know, they really were just... It was weird because they believed their own legend, but at the end of the day, I think they don't have any idea how good they actually were. And I, you know, when we finally sort of squashed the beef one day, we went out one day and we're drinking all day. And we just sort of like yelled at each other. We kind of ended it all. And I just said to them, I was like, you guys, you don't get it. I mean, you're being groomed for everything. You know, you're being groomed to take over the mantle from Howard Stern. All you have to do is, you know, not be overshadowed by a leaf blower.
Right.
You know, they, I don't know, they just didn't get it. And then I was at BCN about 8 years, and during that time I was up, the reason I got to New York was I was up for afternoons at K-Rock against, I believe it was Chris Booker, who had been on the station for quite some time, and he also had a national profile. He'd been on MTV, and then he left MTV, and he was the reporter for Entertainment Tonight, and he was dating Linda Lopez, J-Lo's sister. This is during the whole Bennifer thing.
Yeah.
So whenever there was a J-Lo or a Ben Affleck story, and Ben Affleck, who I went to high school with, he had the exclusive. So he was everywhere. And so afternoons came down to he and I, and I'm told that the program director, I mean, he had also been on Howard's show a lot. And I was told Howard went to the program director and said, hoo, you got to give Booker the job. And he called me and he was like, yeah, man, I got to go with Booker. And I was like, of course, I'd go with Booker over me. That's a no-brainer. And so I want to say the end of 2004, December 31st, 2004, my contract was up. And I was on my way to work. And we'd had a new program director who I'd kind of helped usher in, because when Oedipus was leaving, I knew a bunch of the candidates. And the general manager said to me, well, what do you think of this guy? What do you think of this guy? And I said, well, Dave Wellington, you know, he's killing in Vegas. He's the guy. You know, I didn't realize he was going to come in and be like, okay, let's see. What can we lose? You. And so my contract was up December 31st, 2004. And I was on my way to work, and my agent called me and said, yeah, we got problems. And I said, okay. He said, yeah, they want to go in another direction. I was like, all right, well, I have a compass. You know, I'd never heard that term before.
Right.
And so I said, well, get me a meeting. And I had a meeting with him that day and the general manager. And I basically said, well, you know, I can go wherever you want to go. And they were like, well, we want to go in another direction. I was like, oh, I get another direction without me. Okay, I got it. And so... again, and that was another thing. He ended up hiring a guy who I'm friends with from his station in Vegas to do. I was only doing afternoon drive. He was hired to do afternoon drive and be the imaging director, basically, like, you know, produce all the interstitials that talked, that sort of made the image of the radio station, for probably half of what I was making, so I can't argue that. And then I don't know if you remember this, but Howard Stern and his cast of Oddballs, Stuttering John and Crazy Cabbie, who was a Gulf War veteran who was shell-shocked, complete character, but he was on Howard's show all the time, but he was also doing overnights at the station. He and Stuttering John despised each other. They got into a fight, and Howard, being the master of marketing, decided to settle this beef in a boxing match sponsored by, I think it was goldenpalace.com. Purse was $25,000. Cabbie wins the purse, goes on the air, and says, yeah, I got $25,000. I'm not paying. I didn't pay any taxes on it. The IRS is listening.
Oh, jeez.
And that's it. So I'm sitting home one day. Again, it was like December 31st. I was trying to decide what I was going to do next. And I want to say early January, the phone rang. It's the program director of XRK. And I swear to God, I'll never forget this. He says, hey, dude, Cabbie's going to jail and we could use some help. You want to come down and do some shifts? Oh, and I was like, and that's how I got into K-Rock. That's how I got into New York. And it's funny because I'd also, I just bought my first house, so I thought, you know, well, I really want to do voiceover, so I built this elaborate studio, home studio, and in 2004, that wasn't a thing. So I built this elaborate home studio, and I started to send my demos to agents here, and I got the attention of three, and the one I really wanted to go with, they're like, okay, well, you know, like, call us when you get to the city. And I was like, well, no, but I built a studio. Yeah, that's nice. Call us when you get to the city. And I was like, wow. So I started working. I flew down to New York on a Thursday, or I took the train. I did an audition, 10 p.m. to 2 a.m., Thursday night. And I had, just before I had my iPhone, I had my BlackBerry. And I basically used it as email and text because it wouldn't take calls, or it would drop calls. And, I didn't even know people called me. So I'm walking around, and Friday afternoon, because I had a bunch of friends here, and I get a message from the PD K-Rock. He says, hey, man, I just listened to your demo. Hey, that was great. Great. Give me a call. We'll talk. I said, and I hadn't heard the message. Then the next message I get was... his assistant. Hey, Nick, this is Bianca from K-Rock. I have your schedule next Saturday and Sunday, 2 to 6 p.m. And I'm like, wait, what? And I had no idea. So I started working part-time at K-Rock in New York, 2 to 6 every Saturday and Sunday. And I would take the Amtrak down on Friday, check into a hotel, go out Friday night with my friends, get up Saturday, go to the station, do my thing, go out Saturday night, check out of my hotel on noon on Sunday, go up to K-Rock, which was on 57th and 6th, on the air from 2 to 6, with my bag, jump on the subway, get back down to Penn Station at 7, and take the Amtrak back down to Boston.
Wow.
And I did that from February to October, when I finally was just like, all right, I'm just going to move there.
Yeah.
And here I am, with the Mint.
And you ain't ever leaving.
I don't know. You know, I now that I've left Sirius XM... the first two job offers I got were out of town. And, you know, I mean, my goal is kind of to stick around. I mean, I feel like if I'm here until 2005, that will be 20 years here. So I don't know if you get a set of steak knives or you're fired, like, you know, like Gary Glenn Ross. Exactly.
Yeah.
An official pen, like an I Heart New York pen. But, you know, I mean, if somebody says to me, here's... you know, $650,000, and even if you set the place ablaze, we can't fire you. You know, Mom can't find you in Nebraska. Here I come.
You love interviewing people.
I'm sorry, she wants to say hi to everybody.
Mint's the ambassador of Central Park.
She is. She, dude, I tell you, she, it's so funny. Like, literally, like, in my building, everybody knows her name. Nobody knows, nor could they care less about my name. And she has this thing where she just wants to jump up on everybody and she always jumps up on people's just to say hello, and I'm like, no. And they're always like, it's okay. And I'm just waiting until the day. It's like, my $9,000 Balenciaga pants! I'm gonna have you both killed!
Right.
Anyway, I'm sorry, you were saying.
So you've always enjoyed interviewing people. Who are some of your favorite interviews you've done in your career?
Wow. Well, that's the thing. A lot of them, you know, I will always be grateful to SiriusXM because although the concept of my channel that I went in for, it was called Volume, it was a talk channel about music. And I remember my boss, who was my boss at VH1, had started it. He took me to lunch one day and he says, I got a meeting with Sirius. I was like, oh, really? He says, what would you think about a channel that talked about music but didn't play it? I was like, dumbest idea I've ever heard. But then I said, no, you know what? Actually, if you made it like sports talk for music dorks, that could work. So initially, we would just play like 30-second snippets of songs to make reference. I had done a lot of really interesting interviews before I got to Sirius because I was doing rock and alternative rock and classic rock radio. But when I got to Sirius, they really did allow me to live my, you know, pseudo Larry King dream, where I talked to everybody from Ron Howard to, you know, Ozzy Osbourne to, Neil deGrasse Tyson, 3 or 4 times. And my boss was funny. He would always say, when I wanted to book somebody, well, what's the musical tie-in? I said, oh, don't worry, I'll find one. So, you know, I promoted whatever Neil deGrasse Tyson was talking about. Then I'd ask him about the science of music. And he said, well, reverb. And he would just sit and go off on this screed about, like, what makes reverb. It was crazy. One of my favorites was Ron Howard, who I was a huge fan of course. And he came in to talk about his Pavarotti documentary. And again, you know, my channel was basically, it was a kind of rock-based, but, you know, they wouldn't actually say it, but that's really what we kind of leaned toward. And at the end of the interview, I swear to God, he says, oh, darn, Nick, I should have talked about Wu-Tang. And I looked at him, I was like, Wu-Tang, you! Forgetting his partner's Brian Grazer. And he said, yeah, and there was 2 Wu-Tang series coming out, and I was like, is that you guys? And he said, yeah, that's my partner, and I forgot, Brian Grazer, who put the RZA from Wu-Tang in American Gangster and a bunch of other things. And he was just like, yeah, and I'm sitting there going, I'm talking to Opie Taylor about the Wu-Tang Clan.
Right.
That's insane.
That's awesome.
My favorite part was literally when, I mean, I don't want to sound like a jerk, but when, example, like Huey Lewis, who I'm a huge fan of. I mean, I'm basically, like, I grew up like kind of a hip-hop, punk rock kid, pop music, but I love melody, so I love Huey Lewis. And he was a little leery about talking to us. You know, he needed us to send him our questions first because he's got his hearing issue. So I just made sure I sent him my questions, but then I asked a bunch, and I said that there were not in the list. And I said, so is it my understanding, so your solo on USA for Africa, We Are the World, you got that because Prince didn't show up, and that was supposed to be Prince's line, and he slams his hand on the table, and he goes, Nick, how do you know that? I'm like, I'm a fan! You know?
Wow. That's
that was my favorite thing, if somebody said, how do you know that? I'm like, I'm a fan!
Yeah.
Because I don't think they knew. So, that and, you know, pretty much anybody, Band of the Moment X to, wow. My mom died in 2000. My dad died in 2002. So, I interviewed both. Come on, Pep. Engelbert Humperdinck, who was hilarious, and Johnny Mathis.
Wow.
Who, you know.
Chances are.
As I wear the silly grin. And it was funny too because I walked in and he's like, "Oh, you're cute," and I was like, "All right, you know, I'll take it." What I didn't know is he's like in his 80s. He had this giant, I mean, I've been around a lot of rock stars and they usually have like big black bodyguards. He had the biggest, blackest bodyguard I'd ever seen. The guy had to have been like 7 feet tall, built like this. And he was like maybe 45. And his publicist pulled me aside. He goes, yeah, that's his husband. I was like, well, don't worry about it. I wasn't gonna act on the guy thinking I was cute.
Right.
You know?
Did you ever go through an interview and then after you were sort of debriefing on it go, I wish I didn't ask that question?
No. I mean, you know, I could always think of things that I wish I had asked. Bad brains, respect. I always can think of things I wish I had asked. It's been a long time since an interview really went bad. And if it's gone badly, I've just been like, okay, you know what? Thanks for coming in. You know, and afterwards, I've just said, look, you know, I'm trying to help you sell your little project. You know, but generally speaking, no, I mean, I've insulted guests, you know, sort of lovingly, and they got it. So, like, I remember Ann Wilson punched me.
Like a hard punch?
Well, like a sisterly punch, but it was pretty hard.
Oh, wow.
She's like, shut up, Nick, you know, and that's the kind of thing I love. But, I mean, honestly, I can't think of anything I've regretted. Because, again, you know, my thing is, I've been very fortunate in that I've only had to talk to a couple of people that I didn't really want to, you know? I mean, and I'm not the type that... The only reason why I might not want to talk to somebody is because I don't really feel like I can bring anything out of them that hasn't been, you know... Oh, sorry. It hasn't been, you know, recycled a quadrillion times. Well, that's a good question. Honestly, no. You know, because again, you know, I'm not in it to make people feel bad. It's funny, I think when I was still in Boston and people were like, oh, yeah, he thinks he's Howard Stern, I think there were some people that were a little leery, you know, actors in particular that were a little leery. I remember Anthony Michael Hall, who, you know, I grew up in the 80s, so I was a huge fan. And he was coming in to talk about this made-for-TV movie that he played Bill Gates. He did a great job. And I remember my producer saying, listen, Nick loves actors, and Nick is a huge fan, you know. And so I could tell he came in a little guarded. But by the end, you know, he's slapping five, and he went on Howard Stern the next day, and he goes, yeah, I just want to send a shout-out to my boy Nicky the Pimp in Boston, you know. But, I mean, I can't say that I've ever been like, oh, why did you ask that, you idiot? There's times when I thought, oh, I could have worded that better.
Yeah, or maybe gone at a different angle or something like that. But
well, that's my thing. I mean, I one of my best friends, excuse me, one of my best friends reminds me of when I was still doing my, when I was still working at VH1, the first time I spoke to Judas Priest, I asked Rob Halford about the lawsuit, you know, where the kids got high and played, I think it was Stained Glass backwards, and swore they heard, you know, do it, and obviously the do it translated to get a gun and blow your head off. And I remember a friend of mine who had been working in radio for a long time said, he said, you know, I was amazed at how much he talked about that, because I'm sure that when people ask, they probably say, yeah, man, the trial, that sucked, huh? And I just said to him, I said, you know, if I recall, I said to him, you know, with a band like yourselves who have such a intimate relationship with your fans, especially here in America, what I said is, I remember saying, did it change your perception of America at all when your music was essentially put on trial for these kids who did something crazy and weren't taking responsibility for it? And he opened right up. That I was a little leery about, because generally speaking, every once in a while, you know, publicists are like, don't talk about this, don't talk about that, don't talk about this. And, you know, half the time I'm like, well, I'm not here to, like, make me feel bad anyway.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I do remember Peter Frampton. He was in a bad mood. And I asked his manager, I said, well, is there anything he doesn't... Because I always say to artists, I'm like, anything you don't really want to talk about? Or if I know I'm getting into something touchy, I often say, and this is my trick, I say, look, and stop me if I'm getting too personal. And they never do. But I remember I said to Peter Frampton's manager, I said, so is there anything he doesn't want to talk about? And he said, His latest divorce, losing his hair, and the Sgt. Pepper movie. And I was like, wow, I wasn't going to talk to him about his divorce. I wasn't going to be, you know, a jerk and be like, hey, so what happened to the hair? You know? Yeah, I had my friend that comes alive, like, vinyl. I'm like, who's this guy, you know? Yeah. And I did want to talk about the Sgt. Pepper movie because I was so fascinated, but he's very touchy, so.
Wow.
And he was in a bad mood. He was, because it was VH1, I'll never forget. It's one of the first interviews I did. Hey, up. And my engineer is behind the camera, and I'm talking to him. And, you know, I'm sitting there, and I'll never forget Peter Frampton yells at my engineer, Ed, will you stop moving? You're moving around. I'm trying to ask. I'm trying to pay attention. To you, ask your question again. And I was like, See, that was the first year of the show. Had that happened in the second year, that would have gone completely differently. I would have been like, bro, can you hear yourself?
That's so great.
Can you hear yourself?
You can't make this up.
No.
Oh, man.
And it bummed me out because I loved the guy. I loved the guy. And I was just like, oh, come on, man. But again, I also get, you know, we all have bad days. And it's funny because one thing that I've noticed that a lot of personalities or radio or TV people don't realize is this is work for them. You know, I remember when we first started, you know, my talk channel about music, Volume, my boss said, oh, this is going to be great because, you know, artists are going to really want to talk. You know, they don't really get to talk on music radio. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, when they're doing interviews, they're promoting something. So it's work. So now you're saying, oh, well, they could talk for an hour if they want. I'm like, okay, so that's like saying, hey, you know, you can work overtime for no extra money.
Right.
You know, and I don't think people think about that. But, you know, if hopefully if you're doing justice by somebody, when you're told, all right, you have 20 minutes, you know, they're not looking at their watch. I was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in November. And again, I grew up a huge fan of the Commodores. Lionel Richie solo, not so much, but I respect what he's done. And when Lionel Richie got in, it was myself and two other people from the channel. We were doing mostly tandem interviews, but, you know, my coworkers knew that I was a huge fan, and I was literally told 2 minutes. And I was like, okay. And, you know, he was beyond amenable. I asked him one question about going solo. Then I said to him, tell me what you remember about the night Bob Marley and the Wailers opened for the Commodores in Madison Square Garden. And he looked at me, he goes, how do you know about that? I'm like, I'm a fan.
That's great.
And you know, he said, man, I don't even remember very much because Bob invited me down to his dressing room, and stupidly I went down there, and the smoke, I couldn't even tell you about the show after that. So
that's great.
So, you know, that's it. I mean, and I find half the time, artists don't mind if they feel like you're being respectful and know who they are. It's just their handlers that are like, don't ask this, don't ask this, don't ask this. Avril Lavigne, don't ask anything about her Lyme disease. She just released an album written entirely about her Lyme disease. You know, and she brought it up. And I was just like, all right, we'll go with it. And I look up and I see her publicist in the hall, like, you know, doing this, like, yeah, doing the slash. And I'm like, she's fine. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
So, weird.
So let's close with crystal balling the future for you. It's a couple years from now. Where do you want to be? What do you want to be doing?
You know, that's my problem. I don't really know because I feel like I want to do something that's going to allow me to flex the few muscles I have. Because the thing is, you know, I had a long talk with somebody. I was actually on a panel with somebody about imposter syndrome, and I suffer from that really, really badly. I think when I'm at my best, I might not be the best, but I think there's really not anybody else around that sounds like me. You know, whether it be in terms of just turn of phrase when talking about music or actually talking to somebody or asking somebody, you know, an interview question or whatever, or, you know, just as I say, like, I'm my good friend Erin O'Malley, who is in Boston still, she's been there like 22 years on Mix 104.1. She said to me, she says, you're the best interviewer I've ever seen. I was like, no, I'm not. She said, no, you are. And I said, why? She said, well, because people don't even realize it's an interview. They just, I said, well, that's the thing. I just want to have conversations with people. You know, I just want to talk to people. I mean, I hate, you know, well, it says here in your bio that, you know, I just, as cliche as it sounds, I find people fascinating. I got to tell you, the more I hang out with my dog, the less I like people. But
amen to that.
I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm getting a little long in the tooth for TV, but who knows? Who knows what, you know? I really don't know. As I say, I just left my job after 7 years. I do a lot of voiceover. I'd like to do more of that. I just feel like there's ways to connect that I don't even know if the mainstream has really embraced them yet. I mean, everybody and their grandmother has a podcast now, so I don't know if I'm looking forward to that. But
are you referring to me as your grandmother?
My grandmother was never so cool. My grandmother never ran a rock station. I remember when I got my left ear pierced, my grandmother was like, what are you, some kind of sissy? And I had like long hair, like I was trying to be Prince on a bad day. And, you know, it was long and straight. And I remember I came in off of the out of the rain, and it sort of blew it around. The wind did that to your hair? I'm like, yeah, pretty much. It's called punk, Grandma. Ah, yeah, you look like a punk, all right.
Well, I've enjoyed this so much. I got to meet Mint. I got to see you.
Oh,
we did
this, man,
on last-minute notice, which is even more fun. And
I needed an excuse to drag the Mint out and basically, like, pontificate about myself a lot.
I loved it. I loved every bit of it.
Because I'm sure she's sick of hearing. She's like, will you go back to work? I'm so sick of hearing about your little stories. I'm so sick of hearing about you getting drunk and making out with Band of the Moment X or whatever.
I loved every second of it.
Thanks, oh, and you, Nick, as well, man. I loved it. Thank you.
Thanks for taking a walk.
Don't be silly. I loved it. I don't get to see this this side of Central Park usually. I'm usually further up. This is the nicer touristy rich side. You want a drink? Schmeppermint? Yeah, come and get a drink.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.